Later in the program, Sandy Buffett will be here from Conservation Voters New Mexico. I'm delighted now to welcome to the show photographer and filmmaker Gabe Block. Her new book is called About Love. It's published by Radius Books. It includes a lot of photographs and two DVDs of her films. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
So you have said, and I've heard some of, heard you talk about the book and about your process, that you learned about love, that's the name of the book, through photography. What do you mean by that?
I mean that the first pictures I began taking were in Houston. And my teacher at the time said, and my very first teacher, load your film with your camera with film and go photograph somebody or something you don't understand and you need to understand. And I found myself the next morning at my mother's apartment photographing her, which began this whole, throughout my career, sort of as her as my subject, both video as well as photography. But I did begin in photographing the community that I grew up in other words, her and my father's friends, with whom I had some, 70s rebellious beefs with. I didn't like the way their values had progressed and the way I had grown up without the kind of what I thought of was the important Jewish values.
And what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is these people had assimilated, and they had turned their back on traditional Jewish. In the congregation that I grew up in, it was not allowed for you to come in with a head covering known as a yarmulke or prayer shawl. And the congregation in 1943 set out something they called the Basic Principles, which said that we are not in favor of the formation of a Jewish state. They were in a small town. Houston was at that time of, like 500,000, but it was... there were 18,000 Jews there, and they were feeling afraid of being seen and known as Jews. If they said the word Jew, it was quiet.
So they were afraid. I mean, what you're talking about doesn't sound as much like values to me, quote unquote, as politics. I mean, the head coverings and Israel and...
Well, okay, so that led them away from... The Jewish values like education and just being more in a certain gut feeling level Jewish. I remember when I went to high school, I for the first time became friends with some girls from the conservative congregation. And I came home and one day I said, Oy vey. And my mother said, we don't talk like that. So you couldn't do anything that smacked of old country in this particular very assimilated community.
It's so interesting that during the 1970s, you were longing for a more conservative, traditional way of life when everybody else was rebelling against tradition and things like that.
Is that really right? I wasn't exactly perhaps rebelling against tradition. I was rebelling against... the depth of values. I wanted depth, and I didn't feel that there was depth. And
in the reform.
Yes. And then what happened was I started to go to interview and photograph these people, and I found out that they had very good reasons for not wanting to announce and be public about being Jewish. One said to me about the basic principle against Israel, I found my promised land here. I didn't want anybody to tell me, now you have a country of your own, go there. And so you could really understand that these were people who either were first generation or at least familiar with the experience of European pogroms and anti-Semitism.
And so you learned about love, in a sense, through just getting closer to people and understanding them instead of judging them.
Yes, taking their picture, learning and becoming open by listening to what they told me about their lives, but then taking their picture, and when I came home, seeing that my picture didn't match my judgmental precept. And so, oh, I'm not only learning something from them, I'm learning something from myself, because I've seen what kind of picture I've made.
And that extended also to your relationship with your mother and your family.
Well, my relationship with my mother was to try to figure her out, because she was a very difficult mother. And so that's why I photographed her and videotaped her throughout my photographic life. And I always say, for those early years, even if she wasn't the one in front of my camera, she was the one I was photographing, because I was always trying to figure out what made her tick. I never quite did. But after she died in 91, I couldn't print the pictures while she was alive, because they all looked angry to me. After she died in 91, about a year later, someone came into my studio and said about the picture that I was starting to work on a book about her. And she said, oh, what an elegant woman that is. And all of a sudden I looked at it and I realized I had begun to miss her. And this same picture that had looked angry to me no longer looked angry. So that's a phenomenon, that a picture can change as you change.
Do you think, I mean, not to project incredibly simple psychology onto you, but do you think you were less angry at her, and so therefore the picture looked less angry?
At least by then, a year after her death, I started to miss her. I'm not sure I was quite yet less angry, too much less angry at her, but yes, it was coming. And I was beginning to look at my own culpability in the difficulty of our relationship,
right,
which is what the book is about. It's about redeeming both of us, really, in terms of our relationship.
Your book and your work, I mean, there's very much a film and aspect to it, and as I said before, the DVDs are in the book, and for some photographs, it's useful to kind of know the background. But I was thinking, especially in terms of the mother stuff, and everybody, especially so many women, are dealing with, especially in their young adulthood, their relationship with their mother. And there's also a lot of creativity and self-knowledge, I think, that comes along with having a difficulty like that.
Well, there definitely is. I am and have long been at the point of saying I'm grateful for the parents I had, because I know that it isn't only the benign or benevolent treatment that we get from others that teaches us what we need to learn in this life. It is often the opposite.
And so many artists, I think, are struggling with and coming to terms with precisely what is difficult, and so much good comes out of that that they give to others.
Yes. Well, you know, what you're saying is surprising me in one way, because I when this book first came out, the book about my mother, which is called Bertha Alice, her name, Mother Exposed, I gave a talk at a class, a big class in a, you know, big auditorium about it, and showed the film and talked. And there were probably 150 people in there, and so many of the women spoke. But when they spoke afterwards in the Q&A, when they spoke, they talked about the relationships of their mother to their grandmothers.
Ah, interesting.
Not their own relationship to their mother. So I had this sense that maybe people have solved, have moved on a little bit, and mothers have gotten better. I don't know, maybe that's not true.
There's so many different kinds of photographers, and in the photography that you do, there's so much, I guess it's a combination of self-exploration and exploration of the world around you in a fairly intimate way.
Thank you. Yes, when I look back at my photography, and I think I must have known this going through some, but I realized that I wasn't trying to or thinking that I could make a real contribution or do seminal photography work. I knew that I was learning what I needed to learn about the kind of person I needed to become. I was a barely formed human being when I began photography.
And your early 30s?
Yes. Yeah. That's what it feels like to me. That's what I think. My father died in 1971, and I think I just started to have feelings and get to know myself. And I started to know myself through photography, with photography. I grew up. All of my photography was my own growing up and becoming who I kept seeing other people. I would look at their characteristics and say, oh, yeah, that's what I want to be like. And then I would think I would integrate that into my own self. And it happened over and over and over again. So I learned love from them, and I also learned about what was possible for myself. And it was so much more about that personal stuff than it was about photography for me. Although I love photographing. I don't know how else to say that, too. I just love photographing.
Well, it's a way of relating that is different from having a conversation with somebody, and a kind of deeper way for you, I think, of engaging.
It's totally, the camera totally gave me access into people's homes. I want to come in, I want to talk to you about your life. You know, I started at the very beginning. When were you born? You know, where did you grow up? What was the dinner table conversation at your home when you grew up? What did your family teach you in terms of values? It was always, though, a value-oriented conversation, too, more than anything. I wanted to know, what did they teach, what did they learn at home, and what did they teach their children, and what did they believe was important to them?
One of the things that I found very interesting in this talk that you gave the other day was you were talking about the photographs that you'd done at the Jewish Community Center and the swimming pool there, and one of the things that you said was, you know, that in the country club set where I guess you kind of grew up, people would just leave their kids at the pool. In this place, they would be with their kids at the pool, and the kids were imitating the adults and learning from the adults. And it just pointed, I mean, when you talk about values, one of the main differences, I think, between one community and another in terms of values is whether you want to spend time with your parents, whether your parents want to spend time with you, whether there is an ongoing intergenerational relationship.
Yes, that's right. And that's what I saw at the Jewish Community Center, and that's what I think I loved, because it's so important for kids to see how their parents are with their friends. And then they learn so much about interaction, just about social interaction, and then they feel free to go be with their own friends and leave the parents more readily, and everything becomes much more comfortable. And
now, you
natural.
Switched at a certain point from black and white to color, and that had everything to do with Miami Beach.
Yes, I went there for the first time with my friend Debbie Friedman, who was doing a concert there in 1982. I'd never been to Miami. And we drove down the street going to dinner, and I saw the old people sitting on their porches talking, just porch after porch after porch in these amazing-looking deco hotels. And after dinner, we stopped and just started talking to people on one porch, and I thought, I really want to work with these people. And I did. For the next 4 years, I came many, many trips to Miami. I never moved there, but I photographed all the time.
And there is video, there are films that you made about that, and there are still pictures that are in color. And what's really cool about the still pictures is that you can almost hear them talking.
Well, that's why I felt I had to do film, because I loved how their Yiddish accents. I loved them talking, and I had missed that in my growing up. It was a completely assimilated household and community, and nobody spoke Yiddish. Nobody knew Yiddish. It was completely different, and I felt so much more comfortable there than I did in Houston in my community.
Now, these pictures, the Miami Beach pictures, to my eye, even though the film is great and everything, but the pictures speak for themselves. Then there's another set of pictures, which is the rescuer pictures, and they're so deepened by knowing, for me at least, knowing what's behind them. What's that series about?
Well, rescuers are Christians who rescued Jews during the war, during the Holocaust period of 1940 to 45. And Malka Drucker and I interviewed and photographed. I photographed over 100 of these people all over Europe, in Israel and in this country where they had moved to, as well as Canada. And these people risked their lives to save Jews. There's just no question about it. And when Susan Kaczmarek, who was a curator at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, decided she wanted to have a show of this work, which did open in 1992 when the book came out, at first she said to me, you know, I don't want to do any text with it. I just want to show the pictures. And I said, okay. I had already done a traveling show that was already traveling. I had been for a year of rescuers. And then she called me one day and she said, I see you're right. You can't do this without the words. And she did the same thing I had done in a slightly different format, using old pictures and the first-person story of what they had done right next to the pictures of the rescuers. And it was an unbelievable time. They said they'd never had so many people come in the museum who came to this show. You know, Holocaust is something that people really are curious about. I mean, so many people. And they sold 75 books a week, which is a lot for an art book. Which, of course, it isn't really an art book. It's a book about rescuers.
And, of course, the questions that come out of that are, you know, what would I have done during that period? What am I doing now? Where are the genocides now?
That's what we all ask. Even Dutch rescuers and other rescuers, too, said we thought after the war everything would be different because of the horrors of the war. Nobody would do anything terrible to each other. I think there was some of that after 9/11 for a short period of time. After those kind of crises, we think we'll never go back to the way we were. But people do. People do go back to the way they were. We all do.
And there have been, I was looking on Wikipedia, there have been, according to that source, 25 genocides between 1950 and 2000. Which
I
nobody
didn't,
pays
I
attention
didn't,
to.
I didn't, no, I didn't yeah. realize that, but certainly Elie Wiesel is always saying never again, and we have to pay attention to that in all the other countries.
Exactly.
Where it exists.
So many of the photographs in your book are in people's homes or in the place where they spend time. You don't bring people into the studio and have them pose, but there's a lot of people in their houses maybe kind of posing, but it's sort of some combination between candid and posing. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting was that you, when you photographed children, always made them go into their bedrooms because that was really their natural habitat.
Exactly. I really felt that's where they felt comfortable, and that's where they, it seemed to me that they could project who they were for me to be able to photograph. And that was a joy. And that's the way I've always wanted to take pictures of people at their house. And I use natural light. I'm just not a lighting person. I'm not a huge technical photographer anyway.
Well, I like that. I like the attitude that you have toward technique, which is you learn what you need to know.
That's right. Exactly. And I started out using 4x5 camera. And Aaron Siskin came to Houston to give a talk, and I met him, and we talked, and he says, what camera are you using? I said, 4x5. He says, you can't do that with portraits. You need to be more spontaneous. Get yourself a little Rolly SL66, which was a square format like a House of Blood. I did. He told me to do it. I did it. You know, it was that, a whole lot of my life has been like that. I've felt a lot of times guided in my life. Somebody says something, and I'm just lucky enough to be able to recognize that it's something I need to hear.
Now, there's a series that originated in the summer camp that I guess you went to it, and then your daughter also went to it, a summer camp in Maine.
That's right. I went there in the 50s, Camp Pine Cliff, and then I sent my daughter there. She loved it and couldn't wait to go back. She was there for 7 summers. And the last summer, she was 15, I decided I wanted to photograph and find out what had I done by sending my daughter to a camp of privileged girls. And my life had changed. I had divorced. I had sort of moved away from the conventional Jewish community I was in not physically moved away, but began being friends with more artists and writers. And I was sort of appalled at myself that I had done that. But then, when I got to the camp, all I saw were these beautiful young girls, and all I wanted to do was photograph them. So I never asked them any questions about the questions that I had. Nothing. And so I decided when it was 25 years, it was time for me to go back and find them And
25 years after your daughter was in camp with them.
That's right. I went to the camp in the 50s. My last year was 1955. Her last year was 1981. And that's when I did the photographs. I got permission from her and the camp director to come do the photographs. But so Allison, my daughter, did help me find all these girls because I'm not a researcher. And so I said, Allison, can I hire you to do this? And she said, yeah, that's great. And she found like 65, which was
and
amazing.
And you photographed them. In the book, there are a whole series of photographs of these girls when they were 14, 15, 16 years old, and now whatever,
right.
In the 2000s, in their 30s and 40s.
Yes, they were 7 to 15 in the original 1981 picture, so they were 33 to 40 in 2006 when I did it. And that wasn't quite old enough for them to have experienced many of the bumps that life provides.
Although some seem to have done
some, so. Yeah, some had, yes. But I'm planning to do it again in a few years.
The same people.
This is a smaller number of the same people, yes.
Photography over time, I think, has a certain fascination for almost everybody, because whether it's a place but particularly a person, because you see this 13-year-old face and then you see the 35-year-old face with the same features but such a different person inside, or the same person inside, and it really makes you think about time and how you do or don't relate to your 13-year-old self and things like that.
Yeah, a lot of people will say something about the beauty and the promise and the future that you can see in the young girls, and that there's more lost than they'd like to feel is reality in the older pictures. And these were women who looked good. They were still privileged, for the most part, women, many of them with a husband and two children, you know, some number of children. And they wanted to look good. And so it was a very hard photography for me. It wasn't that I didn't want them to look good, but I wanted to go deeper.
Yeah.
And to show in the camera, in the photograph, what their depth was. But that's why I want to do it again, because I know that life since I saw them in 06, and now it's been 5 or 6 years, has dealt them blows, divorce, and loss, and they've learned things.
When I look at this book and look at your work, it feels like, I mean, you went through a process of coming out, quote-unquote, leaving heterosexual marriage, going into your identity as a lesbian. But there seems like so many more levels on top of that of coming out, coming into yourself as a woman, as a person, as an artist, as some kind of essential person that you are, and looking at the photographs in progression, because they're more or less in chronological order, one sees that deepening in the pictures. It's so interesting.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. But yes, I have to say that I learn something new every day, at least several things. Life is amazing to me at this almost 70 juncture of my life.
And it's not getting less interesting, or...
It is so not getting less interesting. It's becoming more so. I think now, what I'm spending time on right this minute is promoting the book and having some shows here and there. And there's a little show at Radius Books Gallery now. I think sometime in the summer, I may begin to travel, and I don't know what I'm going to talk to people about first. I may do video. It may not be photography. Maybe I won't be able to resist, just as with the photography, I couldn't resist the video. Now it might be video, and I won't be able to resist the photography. But I want to talk to people about where we're going. You know, reading Bill McKibben's book about how we have to accept what the difference in life is going to be, not what can we do about it, almost, because we almost can't do anything about a whole lot of what has happened to our planet. But we have to accept it and talk to people about how they see this. or I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to be talking to people about, but there's so many important, vital things to deal with that I want to get. I've been so much in my own backyard throughout that book.
Right.
And I'm not, it doesn't, I don't feel that I need to be in my own backyard anymore. I've learned enough. I've got that. I need to be out there and
look at the big picture.
Way out there, yes.
Before we go, let's just talk for a moment about the beauty of this book and about the fabulousness that is Radius Books, which is the publisher here in Santa Fe. They did a wonderful job. Perhaps it was a collaboration between you and Radius of designing this, but it's such a really interesting use of layout and white space, as well as the pictures and so many choices about how the pictures are laid out on the page and when pictures face each other and when there's just a blank white page to put focus on the picture on the other page. It's really quite amazing.
Well, I think it is too. And David Chicky was a designer, and I sat there with him a lot, and we, you know, collaborated some, but mostly he would have a lot of things laid out, and we would go through it and, you know, go back and forth about different things. But we totally saw eye to eye. He's a wonderful human being and an excellent designer.
And the book contains two DVDs of Gabe Bloch's films, and there is text about the pictures, but it's separated from the pictures, which is also nice. A wonderful book. It's called About Love. Gabe Bloch is a photographer and filmmaker, and the book has her photographs and films. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It was enjoyable, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Sandy Buffett. She's executive director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be back, Mary Charlotte.
So we always have you on at least once during the legislature, and it's a 30-day legislative session. First of all, what is Conservation Voters New Mexico?
Well, thanks for asking. CVNM is an organization that works to build the political voice for conservation. You know, many people ask me, well, how are you different from other environmental groups? Because we have so many great environmental groups in New Mexico doing very worthy things. And what makes us unique is that we do build that political voice for conservation, and we do that by engaging in politics. And there are three things that make Conservation Voters New Mexico unique. First, we elect pro-environmental champions, and we defeat elected officials who put the special interests above the health of our environment and our communities.
Not just you try to elect them or defeat them, you do.
Yes, we we do. We're very pleased that we've helped elect folks like Commissioner Ray Powell, many members of our state legislature, and, you know, we're in an election year this year, too. So, but, you know, we get involved in politics not just for the sake of being political. We do it so that we can pass strong policies that protect our air, land, water, wildlife, and what we love most about New Mexico. And actually, CVNM is the only full-time environmental lobbyist in the Roundhouse working to defeat all of the attacks on our environment.
Of which there are every year, as I learned from having you on the air, many.
Many, yes. And then we do keep score, and we hold elected officials accountable for their environmental votes through our scorecard that you can see online. Now, you mentioned there are many. We're pleased that for 7 years in a row, we've had 100% rate of success defending against every one of those attacks on our environment. Last year, it was close to 70 bills.
Amazing. That's extraordinary.
Well, you know, we know that New Mexicans are with us. In fact, there was a poll released this week by Colorado College. The poll, which incidentally was conducted by the same pollster as Governor Susana Martinez, so I do hope she's seen the poll. The poll found most New Mexicans say that the state should be doing more to protect our water, air, natural areas, and wildlife, and only 11% of New Mexicans disagreed with that statement. And so, you know, we think we're representing these values in the hallways of the legislature.
And those values go far beyond party politics.
Indeed, indeed. The poll actually found across party lines, you know, that New Mexicans support conservation. There was even, I think, a crosstab in the poll that showed that whether you were an occupier or a Tea Partier, 73% of Tea Party supporters identify as conservationists. 77% of occupiers identify
That's
as conservationists. So I think the disconnect is
Wall
you know,
Street.
I mean
that's the people who aren't getting it.
Oh, and folks, New Mexicans are busy feeding their kids and going to work and or trying to find work and there's a disconnect between how we're being represented in the roundhouse and what the poll finds about our environmental values.
So we are now, about halfway through the 30-day legislative session,
mm-hmm.
which in theory is about the budget, but of course there's always a gazillion bills introduced, as Linda Siegel tells us
yes,
every Friday.
Yes.
What's going on in terms of environmental bills?
Well, we've just passed the deadline for bill introduction, so we're pretty sure we know what we've got on our plate here. We are in defense mode. Unfortunately, the reason why we're in defense mode is, one, because we have an administration that... we've had several bills trying to undo our existing safeguards, but unfortunately we don't yet have a pro-conservation majority in either chamber of the legislature. And if we did have those majorities, then we could be talking about passing visionary legislation, things that would move us forward on conservation.
But they would probably, under this administration, still be vetoed.
Yes, and actually we have evidence of that. Even when good environmental bills do reach Governor Martinez's desk, last year there were several examples that she vetoed. Senator Wirth had a great mercury bill that would have controlled the contamination from your dental fillings when they enter the water waste stream. And that was pocket vetoed by Governor Martinez.
So that was passed by both houses,
mm-hmm.
and then she didn't sign it, which was essentially a veto.
Right. There was also a bill, a tax expenditure budget, which would have provided the public information on all the subsidies made available to corporations in this state, including oil and gas subsidies, and she outright vetoed that bill last year. And then there was a cyclist safety bill, also sponsored by Senator Wirth, and a energy efficiency for higher education facilities. And so that indicated to us that this 30-day session we needed to be focused on holding the line.
Well, what are some places, let's look at some of the bills that you are following. One of them has to do with a uranium enrichment company.
Yes. For many years, we've seen the budgets of New Mexico's key environmental enforcement agencies gutted, the divisions that are in charge of protecting our air, land, and water. And they're gutted because we're told, well, the state just doesn't have the money anymore. So we take a strong interest in tax bills and tax policy. So this one really caught our eye a few days ago. It's House Bill 70. Its companion is Senate Bill 23. It's called Uranium Hexafluoride Gross Receipts. In fact, the representative sponsor is Representative Jim Trujillo of Santa Fe on the House side. And this bill now, I think, has up to 9 lobbyists at this point for a single bill.
What does it say?
Well, what it does is it's a technical fix to an existing deduction. But the deduction is for gross receipts taxes for enriching uranium, a service that right now is performed by exactly only one company in New Mexico. The company is called Urenco, and it's owned by the governments of the Netherlands and the UK, and their facility is in southern New Mexico in Lee County. So we think that it's likely that right now the deduction is rather small, but...
They don't pay, because of an existing piece of legislation, they don't pay gross receipts taxes, or...
It was written many years ago during the time when the state was much more flush than it is now, and when the state was trying to attract nuclear enrichment corporations to southern New Mexico. So it's on the books. The actual bill is a technical fix to the way it's worded, but we think this is a good opportunity for us to review whether it should be on the books at all. The company, we think right now, is probably deducting a relatively small amount. But under the current permit of this company, the value of the deduction is $21.5 million. And we know that this company has filed a permit application to almost double their enrichment services by 2015. So what that means, according to our calculations and the current market rate of their product, is that when the facility is at full operation, that the lost revenue to the state of New Mexico could be approximately $40 million a year.
So what is it that you are trying to accomplish in the legislature right now?
Well, you know, we would love to see this deduction eliminated, but at the very least, we think a simple best practice amendment to this bill would be a sunset clause.
Ah, okay.
You know, we think it's only fair. New Mexico citizens are being asked to sacrifice these days. We hear from the legislature, well, you know, we can't go back on a deduction that was promised to a certain industry, you know, years ago. But public employees were given lots of promises too,
and the film industry,
and you know, so the state has cut there. And if state employees are being asked to sacrifice, we think it's not too much to ask a $1 billion company to. You know, that
pay
we,
their groceries.
Yeah, that an eternal right. deduction is probably not appropriate in our eyes, especially one that will soon result in $40 million in lost revenue annually to the state.
There is not a bill, but a memorial, as probably many of our listeners know, or maybe not, is something that is, if it's passed, it doesn't actually have the force of law, but sometimes it precedes laws. It's kind of like the first pass.
Right, and it sort of sends the sentiment of the body, you know, sending a message. And we think this one sends a really bad message. House Memorial 12, sponsored by Representative Andy Nunez from Hatch, it opposes federal wilderness near the border. And, you know, Senators Bingaman and Udall have been working tirelessly with the communities of southern New Mexico for years to protect the wildlands of Doñana County. The memorial doesn't define border, and in some extreme federal legislation, that's up to 100 miles. So, you know, would that mean then that would include Gila wilderness?
Right.
So
Otero Mesa.
Oh, yeah, sure. And, you know, in the poll I just mentioned, 63% of New Mexicans support the designation of more public lands as national monuments. So we think this memorial is really out of step with where New Mexicans are at and sends the wrong message to our federal delegation.
And so that is the kind of thing that, I mean, as we know, bills and memorials go through a committee process. And so for that particular memorial, if people want to make their feelings known about protecting wilderness area or not, what should they do?
Well, we always believe it's best for legislators to hear from their constituents. And this is first going to the House Energy and Natural Resources Committee within a couple days. And as many of your listeners know, that's chaired by Representative Brian Egolf, who's a conservation champion.
Okay.
That's the only stop it has before it goes to the House floor. And because it's only a House memorial, that's its last stop, and memorials are not signed by the governor. So it basically has two stops, House Energy and Natural Resources Committee and the House floor.
So let the members of the committee, particularly those who represent your district, know your feelings about
yes.
that.
Yes. And so, you know, we oppose HM 12.
Now, there's another bill that it relates to conservation easements.
Mm-hmm. Well, Conservation Voters New Mexico has been working very closely with the land trust community, conservation land groups here in Santa Fe and around the state. We oppose this bill, Senate Bill 200, sponsored by Senator Phil Griego. And unfortunately, what it does is it's going to erode the existing Landowner Conservation Incentive Act. We think that eroding conservation easements in New Mexico and limiting the tax credits is absolutely the wrong direction. We should be encouraging more landowners to look at conservation easements as a way to protect family farms and ranches and open space.
Now, conservation easements basically mean the person who owns the land still owns the land. They get a tax credit for designating the land as conservation land, which can then be used for any kind of outdoor purpose, agriculture, farming, wilderness, whatever, but it can't be built on, be developed.
Yeah, it's one tool in the toolbox for protecting land. And then, so what this bill does is that it guts the program, increasing the tax burden on the landowners, eliminates the participation of out-of-state landowners, which seems a little arbitrary because the real purpose of it is to, you know, identify parcels of land in New Mexico that have high conservation value. You know, whether it's a New Mexico landowner or an out-of-state landowner, if it's New Mexico land that we're seeking to protect. And then it also converts capital gains to ordinary income, reducing the return. And so we have worked as with this coalition of land trust groups, and Senator Griego, I believe, has heard quite a bit from his constituents on this one. So we think the public pressure is really turning this around. The bill does not appear to be moving, but we must remain vigilant until sine die, or adjournment, as they say.
And that's basically a kind of little window into how the legislative process works in New Mexico. Public pressure really does seem to make a difference.
It does. In fact, just before we went on the air, I got a text message from my legislative director suggesting that we get some phone calls into some of the districts on one of these bills we just mentioned. So it's really it really does matter. It's a citizen legislature, and they care. They, you know, when they hear from their constituents, it can make a difference.
And it's a small state, so hearing from 20 or 30 people.
Yes.
Actually makes a big difference.
Indeed, indeed.
Now, there's another bill. When you were on a few years ago, this is when I started to be really impressed by Conservation Voters New Mexico, to whose executive director we're talking right now, Sandy Buffett. And that is that you not only understand, but are able to explain to the public bills that regard really arcane tax policy. And there was this bill a few years ago called TID, T-I-D-D,
yeah,
which I still don't remember what it said.
Increment Development Districts.
Right,
TIDs.
And so the TIDs are back.
Yes, the ghostly stepchild, I think, is Senate Bill 36, Transportation Reinvestment Zone Act. This would give local entities an ability to issue bonds for infrastructure and development. And the way it works is that the incremental increase of the higher taxes will repay the bondholders. And in the case of the one we defeated a few years ago, we were most worried about what it meant to divert that revenue away from the general fund of the state to private sector bondholders. And so we think, this bill is sort of a returned version of, shadow of that bill. And we think it really sets New Mexico on the wrong track for the way we plan and build our cities and how we fund the infrastructure to support them. I mean, if we're going to use public monies, then there should be some public policy goals, such as sustainable, smart growth in those, to receive those kinds of dollars.
And this basically turns it over to, for example, development corporations that do urban sprawl or things along those lines?
Well, and it's so vague and vast, we just think we we don't need to go here again.
It's also interesting, I mean, as an education for listeners who aren't really involved with and don't really want to be involved with the details of public policy, but one thing that one learns is that when a bill is written in a really vague way,
mm-hmm.
that opens a can of worms mm-hmm. years down the line where people can take advantage of it in ways that the public didn't understand or intend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we, it's just so encompassing. And in a 30-day session with the citizen legislature, we don't think there's even enough time to have the proper debate that this issue merits.
Now, there's another bill that has to do with warning signs on lakes and rivers about mercury?
Yeah, this is one we love. This is Senator Peter Wirth's appropriations bill, Senate Bill 39, to make an appropriation to post warning signs on lakes and rivers where mercury levels may pose a risk to children or pregnant women. Now, it is getting late in the session, and this one doesn't appear to be moving, so the budget is, things are getting rolled into the budget right now, so I'm not sure if it's this one's going to make it this year, but, you know, it's just a really simple and elegant idea of that we need to inform folks who may be consuming mercury-laden fish, you know, especially if it's subsistence fishing for their families, and... you know, New Mexico, unfortunately, has mercury hotspots in our lakes and rivers. And so we want to make sure that people aren't consuming too much mercury and having the public health effects of that.
And so basically, I'm thinking this isn't a real high appropriation. In other words, it's basically making a bunch of metal signs and putting them in the ground.
It's a $100,000 appropriation from the general fund to the Department of Game and Fish.
Sandy Buffett, as you were saying before... A very recent poll,
just released a few days ago,
basically tells us that New Mexico voters overwhelmingly support conservation, clean land, water, air. I guess it's kind of a no-brainer, isn't it? Who wants dirty water, land, and air?
Right, exactly. The Colorado College State of the Rockies project. This poll was in several western states and really reveals fascinating information about New Mexicans really being in step with conservation values more than I think the elected officials realize. And so one of the things we found from this poll is that when asked whether environmental regulations have a positive or negative impact on jobs in their state, New Mexico voters are more likely to say they have a positive impact, 46%, rather than a negative impact, 32%. That's so different from some of the rhetoric we hear about, job-killing regulations.
I know. I mean, to call a spade, money controls politics way too much, mm-hmm. and the people who are saying that are basically people who want to be able to pollute with impunity. That's basically the bottom line, isn't it?
Well, we did face last year the so-called small business task force of this administration that didn't really have any mom and pops.
The small business task force didn't have any small businesses on
but
it.
But there were several multinationals represented on it, certainly who have polluted in New Mexico in the past. But again, we think New Mexicans recognize that common sense safeguards that are already in place protecting our air, land, and water are protecting not only what we love most about New Mexico, but really laying the groundwork for, hunting and fishing, tourism industries, the reason why people come here to photograph, enjoy the clean air.
And as we've talked about before, businesses that want to relocate here want to locate in clean areas.
Yeah, CEOs, they want to come to a place that that has a nice quality of life, and so this sort of poll really reaffirms our belief that you can have job creation and a clean environment. There's also 70% of New Mexicans say that increasing the use of renewable energy they believe will create jobs in New Mexico.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so...
If people want to get involved with Conservation Voters New Mexico, either to make their voices heard or just to find out more about the organization, what should they do?
Well, as I said, it's an election year, so it's going to be an exciting time to be a part of Conservation Voters. They can keep up with us on Facebook, Conservation Voters New Mexico on Facebook. We also now have a Twitter account called ProtectNM, for those of you who tweet. And if you'd like to become a member of CVNM, you can go to cvnm.org.
Sandy Buffett is the Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.